Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is the Wealth Club. This is Glenn Greenidge, your host. Tonight we're going to be featuring Lamar Ramsey from David Lerner and Associates. But before we get started, just to let you know, this is the International Black Summit Talk Show Network, and this is the Wealth Club. We are a biweekly from 6:30 to 8 p.m. on Tuesdays. Let me start off by reading the Declaration of the International Black Summit. We declare ourselves, our community, and all communities whole and complete. There's nothing to do except be. We assert that we're responsible for generating community as possibility and distinction. We listen for and grant being to the possibility and creation of unpredictable results. Our conversation of, about, and for those of African descent is one of power, self-generation, abundance, responsibility, unity, and integrity with the possibility of being. We stand for the expression of our spirituality, ending the murders of our men, women, and children, building economies responsible for funding our community, maintaining wellness of being in our bodies, providing human services, establishing nurturing relationships, altering the conversation of who we are in the media, empowering our youth. We declare that our community manifests itself in the world as a contribution in the transformation of the universe. Atlanta, Georgia, October 7th, 1991. And with that, we're going to be specifically talking about building economies responsible for funding our community. And as I said before, we have Mr. Lamar Ramsey from David Lerner Associates. Welcome to the show.
All right, Glenn, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and David Lerner and Associates.
Okay, I'll give you a little background on myself and the company. Well, first, the company is a what's called a regional broker-dealer. It's probably the largest regional broker-dealer in the metro area. We've been around for 33 years.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, 33 years. The company was started by David Lerner. David Lerner used to be an economics and history teacher in the New York City school system. And
Bayside High School, I believe, right?
Yeah, Bayside High School. And back in around 68, 69, the teachers were on strike at the time. And he decided to venture out, and he got involved in some insurance and securities trading as like a supplement to his income while they were on strike. And he found that he had a knack for teaching people about how to invest. And the next, I say, around 1976, he branched out and started his own company. And we've been around since then, and our mantra has always been trying to educate the investing public about how to invest, and primarily how to invest in a conservative way. Our corporate office is in Syosset, Long Island.
Okay.
We have 470 employees and tens of thousands of clients in the metro area. We have offices in, like I said, Syosset. We have offices in Darien, Connecticut, Boca Raton, Florida, Princeton, New Jersey, Teaneck, New Jersey, and also in White Plains.
Okay, great.
We have our own trading department, our own bond trading department, our own clearing department. So we're a pretty self-sufficient unit.
Sounds like it. And specifically, what do you do for them, and what are you, and what are the services that you provide your particular client base?
Well, I'm an investment counselor.
Okay.
I'm a licensed security broker, licensed Series 7 and 63, also licensed life insurance, life and health.
Okay.
My primary responsibilities are to our clients to provide them with a structure primarily for retirement investing. We're a long-run company. We kind of specialize in the retirement area. That's pretty much where we focus. We don't do a lot in the stock market. We've been known as the guys who like to keep it safe. So that's primarily what I do. I cover estate planning. We do a lot of estate planning and insurance for estate planning, helping our clients set up trusts and that kind of thing. So that's primarily what I do.
Okay, great. Okay. Well, we might have to have you back to talk about estate planning, because that's one of the areas that it's very important to our client base, and certainly when people are looking at their long-term goals, that's something that they need to
It's very important how you position your assets in case you become disabled, in case you pass. You really need to put a structure in there so that your heirs have a plan and they know what you wanted to do with your money. So it's a big deal. And then the tax issues for those who make more than $2 million, you have some estate tax issues that need to be taken care of so you can try to get around or avoid paying these high estate taxes that we pay here in New York and in the state and the federal. So.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Well, let's get to our meat and potatoes of this show.
Okay.
And we're gonna start off with the mutual funds, and talk a little bit about how to position ourselves around them. Now, what would you say? What kind of investor is best matched for a mutual fund?
Most people who invest in mutual funds, there's a concept where most investment firms try to put everybody in mutual funds.
Okay.
It's not the best course of action, and I think given what's happened in the markets here lately, we had a nice rally today, but given the reality of the market, especially since last September, what a lot of people are finding out, what we at David Learn Associates have been talking to our clients about for many years, we don't really suggest that once you hit 45, 50 years old, you really need to downgrade on your equities, your mutual funds, because you put yourself at too high of a risk because you don't have as long of an investing time because you're getting closer to retirement. So I would say anybody from 50 years old on down, you're in a pretty good position to have some mutual funds in your portfolio. Once you get beyond 50, you really need to limit it because you need to be in a position where you're in a fixed income position because you need that money to outlive your retirement. Okay?
So
I mean, my position, that's where we stand on that.
We one of our prior shows, we talked about accumulation, protection, and distribution. So it would be in the accumulation or protection area that you would have. You'd be looking to do mutual funds.
So
what are the benefits of mutual funds?
The primary benefit of a mutual fund is the fact that you have a fund manager who's going to pick your individual stocks, usually with some kind of theme or purpose. There may be some theme, and we may get into that a little bit later. But you want that the fund manager's expertise is to pick these stocks that he feels like is going to diversify you within that family of funds. And that's the benefit of it, because most people – when they go into the stock market, really don't have the time to sit day by day and watch individual stocks and their performance, because that's really what you need to do if you're going to go into individual stocks. So what they do is they go into a mutual fund where there's a fund manager, and the fund manager's job is to watch that fund. That's the primary advantage of being in a mutual fund.
And the fund managers, as you said, manage the day-to-day operations of that.
They manage the day-to-day. They will buy and sell. They will buy and sell stocks for the fund. They will keep track of and make sure that you're getting the biggest hopefully the biggest return on your investment that you can. That's what they're trying to do for you.
Okay. Now, is there a benefit to have both mutual funds and individual stocks in your portfolio?
Yes. In my business, I always recommend people to do a little bit of individual stocks. It is important for an investor's own, because those individual stocks, you're the fund manager.
True.
And when you invest in them, you have to take that extra step and understand the fundamentals of what you have invested in. And I usually tell people, if you're going to do that kind of investing, you want to invest in things that you actually use. If you can't live your day without a Diet Coke, and you say to yourself, wow, I always have to have that, maybe Coca-Cola is where you should invest your money. Because it's something that you can quantify and say, I'm in this all the time. If you're maybe a younger person, or you like the Apple computer and you use it all the time and you're always telling people how great it is, that's a place where you can say, I'm going to invest in that, because not only am I a shareholder, but I'm actually using it. I'll be able to tell if things are not going right. I'll be able to tell if the new Mac doesn't work right, and therefore I'll be able to say, well, now, I don't know, the company seems to be slipping. I think I'll take my money out. You need to invest in things that you can use, and that will help you know about. Right,
okay.
That you use. No, actually that you use, because if you invest in things that you don't understand or you don't use, if you invest in things that people tell you, wow, this is the hot thing, and you're like, what is it? I really don't know, but the stock is going up. That's not for you. You really need to invest in things that you use and that you understand. That's where the Warren Buffett piece comes in. That's why he's been so successful, because he doesn't invest in anything that he doesn't understand.
Okay.
Because as an investor, you need to understand what you're in. If the business, your model should be, if the business does well, the stock will follow. And if you're a customer of the business, and you love the business, and you see other people that love the business, then that's where you should be investing.
Yeah, that'll keep, an interesting thing
that
about Warren Buffett.
Yes.
He actually owns McDonald's, and he's had some of his meetings in McDonald's itself.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And that's where, you know, if you just keep it simple like that, you have a better shot of keeping your value and keeping tabs on your money. Because if you like to go to McDonald's and you eat at McDonald's and you invest in McDonald's, if you go into a McDonald's and you start to see that, wow, the hamburger just doesn't taste as well as it used to, or they just don't seem to be keeping the stores up, see, that's your key.
Right.
Or vice versa. You may go into McDonald's and say, wow, these places are always crowded. Maybe I should invest more.
Okay.
That is the key to the whole thing. But if you're in some technology stock and then you're not in technology, and they're talking about chips and they're talking about software that you don't do that for a living, how are you going to be able to dictate and tell yourself whether or not that new piece of software they have coming out is actually works? People who work in that industry will say, "Wow, this is a dud right here. I can't believe they're going to release this." See, but they have the upper hand. They'll be able to save. I'm not investing in that company anymore. See, these are the things, if you keep it simple as an investor, your day-to-day life will also be the tracking of your investments. Keep
Excellent.
It simple.
Okay.
It's the most important thing.
Very good. Very good. Yes, yeah, so I really get that whole use conversation. That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about if let's say I'm looking at my portfolio, how do I include a mutual funds into my portfolio? So you said that maybe I'd have some mutual funds and have some individual stocks. What else might I include if I have mutual funds?
Okay, well, let's get back to the mutual funds because, see, this is where you have to do some, whatever mutual fund you get involved in, you have to do some background checking on the fund manager. You have to find out what their track record is, what kind of funds they invest in. But see, because like I was telling you, when your thing, the stuff that you don't understand about the equities that you're holding in your mutual fund, that's the fund manager's job. You're hiring him. You're paying him to get you involved in those equities and those stocks that you don't understand. So
those industries and sectors that I don't understand,
right,
I would pick a fund manager
that is
focusing on that particular.
Exactly.
And, you know,
so if it was, let's say you really don't know technology, but you know that it's something that's growing, but you just don't understand it, then you'll pick a fund that's specializing in that sector, and you want to go through all the different funds and find a fund manager that you can say, okay, you know, this guy here, I kind of get how he invests. I think this would be a good one for me. I tell you another key thing about a fund manager. You really want to pick a fund manager that actually invests in the fund that he's managing.
Oh,
very
say some
important.
More about that. Say some
very
more about
important.
That.
Because if the fund manager, his job and his income is based on how well he performs, and he invested in his fund, and each fund, you will be able to find out how much they invest in their fund. It's in the prospectus.
Oh.
They send you a yearly and quarterly update on the fund, and it says in there how much they've invested. They have to disclose that because that's like an insider thing.
Right, like insider trading would be
right.
For
right. Okay. They're principals that are investing in their fund. And you want to know how much of this guy's personal money is in this fund. If you see a fund that doesn't have the fund manager has got very little money in the fund, then that could be a flag to you that if he doesn't believe, then I shouldn't believe. Now, those are little tricks. Now, see, these are things that people in my position who sell for a living may not tell you.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
But when we look, as an investor, when I look at a mutual fund, I'm looking to see, is the fund manager invested in this? Because I want to know, if I'm in, I want to know that he's in. Or she's in, or they're in, because sometimes there's more than one fund manager.
That's very
important. And then you want to know if the fund manager is managing a fund on technical stocks, you want to know, does he have a background in this? Did he come from one of these companies? What does he know about that particular set of stocks that he's involved in? And they'll have their resume posted. You want to know that. So if it's, let's say, a REIT fund, then you want to know, is the fund manager's background in real estate? Is it in REIT? Why is he pooling this particular equity pool together? So
what's his expertise?
What is his expertise? That's what you're paying for, and you will be paying for that. You know what? Most mutual funds, all mutual funds, you always pay.
Right,
and that's something else that's very important about your funds. Now, within an IRA, you think you're not paying, but you are paying. You're paying fees within the IRA that pay the fund manager. So you should look at it, even though you're not seeing that money come out of your – it is coming out of your retirement account. So you should treat it as though I'm paying these people and I'm going to pick the best person because they're going to get paid out of my money.
Gotcha. Now, so there's a couple things. I just kind of want to do a quick recap. So certainly you want to know that the fund manager has the particular expertise via resume.
Exactly.
You also want to know that they're in the fund themselves.
Exactly.
And you want to understand what the fee, because there are different fees that the manager of the fund would get. So what would be like a range of the fees?
So what it is, with mutual funds, they usually come in three categories. There's what's called A shares.
Okay.
Now, A shares They have their own set of rules, and sometimes this thing confuses people, but it's not really all that confusing. Simply, A shares just mean that when you pick the mutual fund for your portfolios, and they say we're an A share fund, it just means that you're going to pay a commission up front.
Okay.
Okay? That's all A shares really mean. I'm going to pay up front. Now, with that, when you buy into that mutual fund, the more money you put into those funds, the cheaper the sales load. They call it a load. The sales load or charge will be. And that's what's called a break point. So if you put in, let's say, $25,000 into the fund, they may say, okay, it's 5%. And this will be in the prospectus of the fund that you're buying. It'll tell you what the breakpoints are. And then it may be $25,000 to $50,000 may be at 4.25% sales load, and so forth. The more you put in, the less you pay.
Okay. Okay.
Now,
okay.
That's A shares front-end load. And the break point, what confuses people about that, because you got to be careful with it. If you talk to a broker about it, and you say, I want to put $26,000 in the mutual fund, and he says to you, well, maybe you should put $25,000 in. Let's just make it an even 25. You may be saying, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But he may be saying, wow, at 26, I get 4.25%. At 25, I get 5%. These are the little things that they know the customer is not quite so sure about or not even thinking about. So you got to be, when you look at a mutual fund and you get the prospectus, you should look at where the break points are, and from there decide how much you're going to put in. Remember, it's always your money, so you got to be careful with that. But A shares and front-end loaded funds, by nature, are always the cheapest funds to get in, because once you pay your front-end load, and you pay less by more, the more you put in, the less you pay. When you get out of an A share fund, you don't pay anything, and the sales charges that are built in for marketing and advertising that all funds have is a whole lot less.
Okay.
Now, the second kind of fund that you see a lot of people get into are the B-share mutual funds. And the B-share mutual funds, you'll get a sales talk of, wow, you can get into this fund and you don't have to pay anything. Well, there's no such thing as not having to pay anything. What it is you don't have a front-end sales load. What you have is really a back-end sales load. So you put $25,000 in, and $25,000 goes in without any money coming out, but it's based on how long you stay in. The longer you stay in that mutual fund, the less your charges go down. So I'll give you an example. If you get into the fund, you didn't pay anything to get into it, you stay into it, let's say for a year, you may pay 5%. You stay in it for 2 years, you may pay 4% if you get out. You stay in it for 3 years, 3%, and so on. And then usually after 6 years of staying in the fund, you don't pay anything if you get out. You can get out without a sales charge. But what happens is all those years that are in there, there is a fee called a 12B1 fee that's coming out. Now, these 12B1 fees are taking a piece of your profit and
off
they're paying
the top. Okay.
Off the top, and they're paying the brokers and the brokerage firm out of that, because even a broker who sells you a B-share mutual fund is usually making about 4%. But he knows he's going to get his money broken down into individual fees over the life of the time that you have it.
Okay.
So they don't have breakpoints, but they do have back-end fees. So you just got to understand, no matter what you do, you're going to be paying.
Okay.
And then there's another one called C-shares, which you don't see as much of. C-shares, they have either front-end loads or back-end loads or heavy fees. it's all based on the perspective. That's another category, but usually it's either A shares or B shares that you usually see in the market.
Now, there used to be one called a no load. So is the no load really like this B share?
Well, the no load is the B shares.
Okay.
After
the 6 years or whatever.
Yeah,
okay.
it's really a gray area. I mean, technically, they shouldn't be saying no load.
Okay.
They mean no load means no front end load, but there is a back end load, and there are fees called contingent deferred sales charges. And yes, they will get their fees. There's no such thing as not paying in a mutual fund.
Gotcha.
So just understand that is it's sometimes it is not, it's kind of transparent. Those 12b-1 fees come out, and you really have, you know, you have to look at your annual statements to see them, but they are there and they are coming out because they're going to pay the 4% commission on the B shares to the broker up front, and they're going to take those fees until they get that money back. The actual fund is going to keep taxing you over the years until they get that money back out. So yes, there's no front end load, but there's no such thing as a no load.
That's
there's
a
always
no load.
A load somewhere. Yes,
and
which
you
is
said
a sales
12B1C is what they use to take out to provide for the commissions, correct?
Yeah, they provide for commissions. Okay. They provide for marketing and advertising of the mutual funds. So, like, when you see those commercials for the different funds, those funds, 12B1 fees are what's the people who are in the fund, their 12B1 fees are paying for that commercial. And they actually have to send a audited record that this amount of money came out for the advertisement of the funds. Or you see a fund in a magazine advertising, one of the financial magazines. That 12B1 fee is where it's come from. And also, those are fees that are going to a broker. They get these 12B1 fees, and they're small fees from each person, but they accumulate. You may have,
sure,
you know,
sure,
500 customers that are giving you 12B1 fees, and every month you may see, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 in your account every month just from those accumulation of those fees from all the people that you sold mutual funds to.
Gotcha. And that comes
out whether or not the mutual fund makes money or not.
Yeah, like you said, off the top. So that's
right.
Expenses.
So these are things that you need to know about so you can make a qualified decision, because most people don't realize is that the A shares, even though you pay up front, they're actually the cheaper mutual funds, the ones where you pay up front and you're done.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's how the fees work with the mutual funds.
Now give us a little idea of the different kinds of niches, because you talked a little bit about maybe – one was the technology, another one was the real estate. What are some of the kinds of niches? Because I know some are socially conscious.
There is probably 3,600 mutual funds. If you get the New York Times.
3,600? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, if you get the New York Times I believe it's the Sunday edition, you'll see them all listed. There's every kind of, I mean, every fund manager has a theme that they think is the best theme ever.
Okay.
I ran into one recently that made me laugh. It was the Vice Fund, which is
the Vice Fund.
Yeah, that's stuff like the cigarette companies, the gambling companies, you know. Anything that liquor companies, anything they
would be considered a vice. Okay.
Right. and they have a family of funds. And some people's theory was good times or bad times. People use their vice when they're happy. People use their vice when they're sad. There's always, you know, and you have to, like, you have to pick what you feel is comfortable to you, because the person that I met that had the vice fund. They hung in there a little bit too long because they said, oh, I went to Vegas and there was nobody there. Well, that was the time to get out of the fund.
Yes.
Because,
exactly.
You know, yeah, that was some vice that actually was starting to wither. So you got to be careful. You just want to pick funds And you want to pick that manager, like I said, that's actually heavily involved in that fund. He's invested in the fund. He has background in that family fund. But there are thousands of different variety of funds that you can choose from. Some don't classify individual things that the companies are. Some will say, well, this is a large cap company, and we have some mid cap and small cap, and they're all doing different things, but the smaller the company, the more the risk. So they're spreading risk out among the sizes of the company. You'll see a lot of that. So, you know, it's the world. I mean, you could spend years going through all of them.
So the other aspect of it is you'd want to look at their asset allocation within that fund to see what particular categories within that vice, for example, within that category, what percentage is gambling, what percentage is smoking, or what have you.
Exactly.
And then you want to match the predictability of that particular industry or sector, how it's going to perform in the next, you know, 5, 10 years or however long that you're looking to invest in the mutual fund.
Exactly. And you also, you know, when you read your perspective, you want to read, they're going to explain to you also what their theory is on it. You want to read that.
Why they think it's good.
Why they think it's good.
Okay.
Yeah, you want to read that. Because that's where, when you read that, then you can figure out, oh, okay, this is for me. I believe these same things. I kind of have an idea that I feel like, you know, I feel pretty strong about this also. And you at least should do that. The worst thing you can do with a mutual fund is pick a fund just because you heard other people are picking it and you think it's the hot thing.
Okay.
You need to, you know, I try to get people as best I can to get away from that kind of thinking. It's your money.
I remember when I first started looking at mutual funds back in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Fidelity Magellan.
Mm-hmm.
Was the big firm, was the big mutual fund at that time.
Right.
But it had closed out because it had gotten too big, I guess, or something. So I you know, because everybody was talking about that one. And
right.
I thought, let me find out about that. So I fell trapped, I fell prey to that myself in looking at it. But fortunately, I wasn't able to get into it, so it forced me to look other areas.
Right.
Rather than just what people had said about it.
When it comes
go ahead.
It comes to equities, mutual funds, individual stocks, you don't really want to follow the herd because there is the technical side of the stocks where the company makes X amount of money, there's X amount of profit, and then there's this other side of the stock market that's based on, I heard this was the hot thing. And then that ends up driving up the price of the stock, and it's not based on any kind of profitability. It's based on I'm following the herd.
Perception.
And that's where
so
people can get
based.
Right. Because people can get burned doing that because nothing goes to the ceiling. At some point, it's going to reach its ceiling, and it's going to come all the way back down to its value, its true value.
So it's true value. It's true value.
So you got to be careful about following. If you're getting into something that's already at its closing and everybody's jumping in, you're probably too late.
Gotcha.
You need to be in it and say, oh, I was in this when nobody was talking about it, but I believed in it, and I saw that the fundamentals were there.
Okay.
So you got to be careful about getting into things at the top, because that's what happened to the stock market here recently. It was a lot of fluff in there, a lot of fluff.
So it just corrected itself.
It corrects itself. It's always going to correct itself. Usually not this severely, but we've come to find out that the fundamentals on what drove the market to 14,000 was actually phony accounting. Money being put into the system at a too heavy a pace, too much free money, so it wasn't real. So when it adjusts back down, it'll go below reason and then come back up to where the real true values, and that's hopefully what everybody's waiting for to happen now. They're waiting for these values to come back. There's a lot of companies that are way undervalued as far as their earnings. They're earning as well, but their stock value is very low right now. So,
okay.
You know, you want to make sure that you're not following the herd. And, you know,
gotcha.
We learned that lesson with the dot-com thing, and there were people all over the place saying these dot-com companies are making money hand over fist with their stock, but they're not selling a thing.
Gotcha.
That's the epitome of following the herd. You got to be careful with that one.
Okay. Got two more questions. One is, are the mutual fund managers, are they considered technical? Are they picking stocks on based on technical analysis, or are they picking it on value analysis, or any combination thereof?
They're using all of it. They're using
okay.
all of it. Most fund managers, you know, they have a team, and they have a person for fundamentals, a person for technicals, and yeah, they're actually doing it by committee, and they're picking these stocks based on all those variables. And, you know, truth be told, there's no such thing as I know what's going to happen. I mean, at the end of the day, it's still going to be a very educated guess.
Gotcha.
Bottom line.
Very good. Very good. And the one last question in mutual funds, how do you get out? When's the time to get out of a mutual fund?
Depends on some factors. Like we said in the beginning, how old are you? What's your timeline?
Okay.
If the fund has been a performer for you, and even in a down market, you see that the companies within the fund that they picked are still making money. It just seems to be the whims of the market seem to be driving it down. It's not based on the actual performance of the individual stock. Then I would say
okay.
you stay in.
Very
you stay
good.
In or you buy more.
Gotcha.
Because
gotcha.
At the end of the day, it will correct itself.
So it really depends.
It just depends. And once you get to be a certain age, like we said in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
regardless of how well the fund has done for you, once you reach a certain age, you need to have a line in the sand where you say, I need to start getting out of equities and moving my money into more a fixed asset income position, fixed income once you reach closer to retirement. So it's just, those are the things that will get you out of a mutual fund.
Excellent. Once again, this is the International Black Summit Wealth Club talk show. I'm featuring our guest tonight, Mr. Lamar Ramsey from David Lerner and Associates, and we've just completed the conversation of mutual funds, and we're actually going to move into a REIT, a real estate investment trust. So what exactly is a REIT?
Real estate investment trust. What it is, it's a security with its basis being land. All REITs are all based on the land, the real estate. Now, the way they're put together, the land as a REIT has to have something on it that's making money, because that's the investment part. That's the goal. What can I put on this land that will generate income? So most REITs have some kind of theme. They will own the land that they purchase. They will own the building usually and the business in the building. And all of that, they hope that the building and the business will add value to the land so they can sell it later. And then while they're holding on to it, the business generates income or dividend.
Gotcha.
So you really what you're doing is you're adding value to land in a REIT. That's what it is. A lot of people don't realize that they use REITs all the time. Pretty much any mall you've ever been in anywhere in the country is a REIT. That's why when you go into the mall, you see the same stores, you see the same food court. It's a formula. We're going to take this raw land, we're going to put a mall on it, we're going to put a JCPenney on one end, or a Nordstrom on the other, or a Macy's on this end. We're going to make a food court, we're going to have a McDonald's, we're going to have a Taco Bell, and we're going to put them in the same place, in the same order, the limited, in the same spot, because they want the same result. Their whole goal is to put value on that land and get income from it. That's the goal.
Okay, okay.
So that's what a REIT is. Okay.
And you're saying that most of the malls and shopping centers and what have you are REITs?
Almost 99% are REITs. Yes.
No kidding.
Yes.
Really?
Okay. Hotels, a lot of them are REITs. A lot of chains like McDonald's, people will put the franchise into the REIT. So they say, if I can buy some land here, and every time I buy land here in this area, I put a McDonald's on them, I know that I can get a certain amount of income because everybody knows McDonald's.
Everybody knows, right, exactly.
So the investment firms that put together REITs, they're not so much interested in that business. They want a business that's easily recognized, that already has a market, that has a cash flow just by opening its doors. Because remember, their focus is, I have land, I need to put something on it that generates income. And with that, I'll be able to sell shares of this to investors. So I can bring in more money and buy more land and open up another McDonald's. See, that's the goal of the REIT.
Gotcha.
And the investor in the REIT is investing money to help these REITs buy more land and buy more businesses. In turn, they're getting a managed property and a managed business, and they're getting a dividend for their investment. And as a REIT owner, you actually own directly the land, the building, and the business in the REIT. So you get the same benefits as if you were buying houses or real estate on your own. You get the depreciation. You get all of those goodies that you get in your write-offs, just like you would if you were owning these things individually yourself. You are owning them. You're just owning them with other people.
Interesting. So if I was an investor who was sensitive to not wanting to manage a whole lot of things, REITs are an easy way to get into real estate and still get a piece of the action and some profit from that.
Exactly, because it's a cash-in, cash-out business. If you bought a home, you bought an investment property, and you would have charging rent, that would be your dividend. It's the same thing with the REITs. You're getting your dividend. The only difference is you have a manager of your properties, and that manager is taking a piece of that dividend and then giving you a piece of the dividend. So you're getting your rent without having to manage anything.
Gotcha.
That's the whole piece. But when you do your taxes and you get your 1099, it's looked at just like you collected the rent. You got a certain amount of rent for the year. You're going to get the write-offs on the properties just like, and we pass them down to you on your 1099. You get your depreciation, so you don't pay taxes on all, some of your taxes are deferred. You don't pay taxes on everything because you get all your write-offs. If they had to update the building, they take all that out, and they defer that.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So that's all passed through.
That's it.
Didn't realize that. Okay.
Yes, so it's a direct ownership in the real estate.
Okay.
So that's the beauty of it. Now, there are differences. Now, you have some REITs that trade on the stock market.
Right,
You get your dividend. You get your depreciation on your dividend because you own the real estate. The difference is that their values, their share values fluctuate with the market based on how many people are buying the shares. It goes up and down. And then you have REITs like the one we have at David Lerner Associates that's private.
Okay.
It's private is not quite the right word. I should say it's not a publicly traded.
It's public, but
it's not traded on the stock market.
Okay.
So the share price is fixed. So you don't have.
So you're able. You're able to control it because it's not on the stock market. So
because it's not on the stock market, exactly.
Gotcha.
It's fixed. So it's a more conservative approach. The other thing is that most REITs, and this is something that they got a little caught up in here, the publicly traded REITs, about 90% of them or better, they also leverage their properties. So they take the investors' money.
Okay.
They buy the land. Then they say, okay, instead of getting more investors' money to build the building and to put the business in it, they go get a loan and say, we're going to put this particular building on it. They leverage. They put a mortgage on it.
Okay.
And that mortgage becomes an expense and a write-off. And then the piece of the mortgage that they take out, the investor is also entitled to a piece of that. So they end up paying that part back out in a higher dividend if they take out a mortgage. The downside to it is if the economy contracts and you have investor money in a REIT and there's a mortgage on it and the business slows down as far as income, that mortgage still has to be met, and that could put a strain on the REIT.
Okay, so that will put a strain on the profit.
On the profits, and you'll see your dividends start to go down because there's less money because the mortgage has to be met first. That's how most REITs are run. The REIT that we have at David Lerner Associates, we don't carry any debt. We do not mortgage our properties. So it's a different approach that we have. We raise our money from our investors. We buy the land, the building, and the business all for cash. And we return a cash dividend to our clients in the form of a dividend. And then when we sell our properties, we return cash back to their portfolio. There are no leveraging. Our company, I don't think I stated this in the beginning, but our company has no debt. We have no debt. We have no internal debt as a company, and we have
really?
No debt on our investment products, which is almost unheard of. But we've been this way for years. This is not something new. We've been this way for years, and we didn't just change because the market is like, we've been telling people for years that we just don't believe in debt. So it's a different kind of approach, and it's really a conservative approach to real estate. We finance ourselves.
Gotcha. Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. Are all REITs commercial properties only? Or could you have, like, different combinations? Could you have maybe single families or multi-families that are still residential are part of REITs?
Yeah,
okay.
You could.
Okay.
I don't know one in particular, but it's open. A REIT doesn't even have to be – it's land first. It's real estate. It could be that maybe you have a REIT in Texas and your thing is gas and oil wells.
Right, okay.
You own the land, and you own what's underneath that land, and if there's gas underneath there, that's your revenue stream.
There are
different REITs do different things. Now, our particular REIT at David Lerner Associates, we do Marriott and Hilton Hotels. That's our specialty.
Right, the Apple REIT.
The Apple REIT. That's our specialty. Okay. We buy hotels for all cash. No leveraging, and we return that dividend, and then we sell the hotels about every 4 to 7 years and return our cash back. So it's cash in, cash out. It's fixed because our share price is $11 a share. So when you invest in it, your principal amount either goes one or two ways. It either stays the same because you're taking your rent and you're putting it in your pocket every month, or it goes up because you're reinvesting your dividends.
Okay.
Very simple.
And
there are no loads on there. There's no fees and loads. It's straight. Whatever you invest in there, you get 8% on your money at this time. With the one that's open now, you're getting 8%. And it's very straightforward. But there are Marriott and Hilton hotels. There's an article that was out in Hotel Magazine. We were the number one buyer of hotels last year. We bought 79 hotels. And we bought so many because, as you can imagine, with us being a cash buyer and no one else being able to get a loan, we were the only game in town.
Oh, absolutely. So
we ran around with some $700 million buying hotels all last year, and we were showing up to buy hotels, and we were the only person, the only company showing up to buy these hotels, and we bought them at deep discounts because we were the only ones. So it's a powerful position that we're in with this all-cash position.
Now, let me ask you this now. What investor profile would I be looking for a REIT? Is that a long-term? Is that can I do that after 50?
Yes. You can be – this is what's considered. We're allowed to call this conservative, moderately conservative investing. So
okay.
It fits a large range. It fits a large category of investors. There are investors who are younger. Hello, Glenn?
Yeah.
There are investors who are younger.
Yes.
Who invest in this type of investment because they're getting a fixed income, and then when we sell the hotels, they're getting also growth with a capital gain in their account when we sell them for a profit, because we won't sell them unless there's a profit. And then it's for also the older person who doesn't want to see their portfolio go up and down with the rises of the market. They want to be in a fixed position. They want income, but they also want some growth in there. They want a little growth. They don't want to be sitting like in a fixed position where the only thing they're getting is dividends. So it fits a large range of people.
Gotcha. Now let me ask you this. When you have what they call a closeout, so you'll have – there's a number of Apple REITs that are out there.
Right.
Let's say that one is closed off. So I'm invested in one that's closed out, and you're moving to another one for new subscribers.
The reason why we close them, we have $5 billion invested in Marriott and Hilton Hotels.
Okay.
It's too big to put them all in one REIT. So what we do is we have a cutoff. The last two or three have been, once we reach $1 billion in cash, we close it. Because 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road when we sell them, we're going to sell that $1 billion block of hotels.
Gotcha.
It's easier to sell because if you make it too big, you may not be able to find a buyer with enough cash to close it out. So we break them up into smaller pieces.
Okay.
That's the only reason. But each program is the same. It's just that we have to break them down because in 07 we sold two big blocks in 07. But it would have been probably too big to have them both together. And we sold one to ING, the bank and investment firm, the insurance company, and we sold one to Midland America. That's the only reason why they're all the same. So even if you miss one that's closed out and you get into the next one, it's just like the one previous to it.
Now, if I'm in one of the ones that are closed out, my money still is growing and being managed and so on and so forth until you sell all of the properties at some point in time in the future?
Yeah, then we'll sell all of the properties internal. So when it's closed out, you can't add any new money to it.
Okay.
Can't add any new outside money, but you can reinvest your dividends within it.
Okay.
And grow your principal within that individual REIT that's now closed, but you can't add any new money to it once it's closed.
The prospectus
says once we reach $1 billion or $2 billion, or like the new one is $2 billion. Once we reach that amount of cash, then the only shares that can be gained forward are those being reinvested within the REIT. Right.
Okay. And what's the life cycle of the REITs?
We say 7 years. We've been averaging about 4 or 4.5 years, and then we sell them.
So when you do the sell, then you then pretty much liquidate that REIT and then start.
Right, and your money will come back into your account cash.
Gotcha.
And then you'll have to decide if you want to go back into the REIT again, or you're going to buy mutual funds, or you're going to whatever you're going to do. Your money, you put cash in, you get a cash dividend every month, then we sell it, you get cash back out into your account, and then you have to decide after 3 or 4 years what you're going to do. And we've been averaging over the 4.5 years, we've been averaging, if you reinvest your shares, we've been averaging 89% on your money. And if you took your dividend and put it in your pocket every month, we've been averaging 65% on your money.
Wow. And that that mostly has to do with the profits that you
what's happened is the dividends start to go up as the years go by, because with a REIT, 90% of the profit, the net profit, has to go back to the investor. So as the hotels start to generate more and more income, our dividends tend to go up. Like we have Apple 6 is at 8.2%. It used to be 8.
Okay.
So it started to creep up because those hotels have been around longer. So when you add it all up, we've been averaging about 16% if you took your money, and we've been averaging almost 18% a year, almost 19% a year if you reinvest your dividends. And that adds up over the 4.5 years to almost 89% on your money. You put in $100,000, you got $189,000 4.5 years later. That's what we've been averaging. So that's the history
that's
of it.
Great.
So you it's a nice investment because it's cash in and cash out and it's fixed.
And you also have the option at that point in time to determine or to move into to go back in or to go another direction depending on where you are in your portfolio establishment and building.
Right. And then you have your tax advantages. If you put in $100,000 and you're paying and you made 8%, you made $8,000. Of that $8,000, you're going to pay taxes on approximately 6 and change, and the other money is going to be tax deferred. So there's some tax advantages in there too. And if you have an investment like this in an IRA, those capital gains and those dividends that you're accumulating, you're not going to pay any tax on them. You're only going to pay tax in your IRA on what you take out. If you only take out $100, you're only going to pay tax on $100. You can have an 89% gain in your account, and if you don't take any money out, then you just have an 89% gain in your account over those 4 years.
And that would be
in an IRA,
IRAs?
In a qualified pension account. You wouldn't have any, you wouldn't have any gain. So we have a lot of investors who like to put this in their IRA because they say, wow, you know, I'm getting good dividends. It's fixed. I know my IRA is going to go up every year. And then when they sell it, I'm going to get a nice jump, maybe 25-30% jump in my money. And that's a capital gain that I don't have to pay. I may only need $3,000 from the account for the whole year. I may need nothing. So, you know, it's a very nice niche investment that has good growth, no leveraging, all cash, and it pays a nice dividend, and it has a nice track record. That's why we like it so much, because it's so simple. There's no fees and commissions, none of that stuff. Whatever you put in, that's what you get your 8% on. You also get a discount on the hotels. Any hotel we have, we're probably the second largest owner of Marriott's and Hilton's, the extended stay hotels. They're all over the country. You stay in a hotel, you're an owner, you get a discount, a 15% discount.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
You actually own the hotel. And you know what the other thing, Glenn, is beautiful about this? As an investor, like I told you, you need to know what you're investing in. You can actually call the hotels, anyone in the country, and say, "Listen, I'm one of the Apple REIT owners. You know, how are we doing? Like, do you have are we full this week?"
Okay.
You can do that. It's all the numbers are listed, all their properties, and when you go see them, they treat you like royalty because they know that they wouldn't even have a job if you hadn't put your money in there. So they know that. They don't know you could have put $5 million in. They have no idea. So they treat everybody the same.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Well, listen, we're just about to wrap up this segment. Thank you so much for being on the show. Would you let our listeners know how they can get a hold of you?
Yes, I can be reached at David Lerner Associates. I'm in the corporate headquarters in Syosset. I can be reached at 516-465-5063. Again, that's 516-465-5063. If you have any questions about anything that we talked about today, I'll be happy to answer your questions. And that's pretty much it.
I've got a question from someone in the chat room, and the question is, What is the basic cost per share? I think you said that it's
$11 a share is the cost per share. So it's very simple math. It doesn't change. If you need to, let's just say you got into the REIT and you needed to, let's say, get out of the REIT before we sold it for some reason. You went in at $11 a share, and you're going to get your money out at $11 a share. So it's fixed.
Okay. Very good. Well, listen, thank you so much for bringing all of this great information on mutual funds. We learned a lot of things about the upfront loading and the back-end loading on the mutual funds and the 12B1Cs and how that's manipulated and used and that we need to be aware of. And thank you for all this great conversation about the REITs. Again, this is Lamar Ramsey from David Lerner Associates, and this is the International Black Summit Talk Show Wealth Company, and we're getting ready to move into our third segment. Mr. Ramsey, you can certainly stay on if you'd like. I know you've been on for an hour, so you might want to get to your family.
Okay.
We're going to open it up. We're going to open it up to a couple of other listeners. Let me find out if they have any questions for you.
Okay.
And we'll go from there.
Okay.
I'm going to start out with listener number, area code 773. Go ahead. You're on the air.
This is James Gilmore, our Glenn.
Oh, hi, James. How are you doing today?
Good, good. I was just waiting for this segment to come to a positive conclusion, and then I have my two associates that will be joining me. So I'm just sitting waiting for you to bring me on.
Okay, hold on a second. Let me just check to make sure that there no one has any questions for Mr. Lamar Ramsey before he leaves. Hold on. 513, area code, you're on the air. Sorry, 513, you're on the air.
Yes, this is for James Gilmore.
Okay.
Confirm that I'm here.
Oh, okay, great. Okay. Hold on, please. And then we've got someone from the area code 5561.
That's right. That's me.
Are you? Okay. And you're also for?
Yes. I'm attorney John Marino from the law firm of Marino, White, O'Farrell, and Gonzalez.
He's
okay,
with me as
good,
well, Glenn.
Well, listen, Mr. Ramsey, thank you so much.
All right. I appreciate your time, Glenn.
Thank you for your time and for all the great information. We'll be in touch.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Mr. Gilmore, I'm
going to How you doing, Glenn?
I'm doing excellent, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing fabulous, and thanks so much for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. So tell us a little bit about what you've got going on.
Well, briefly, I want to thank you for inviting me to be on the show. Most of the listeners are people from the International Summit?
Yes. We've got some from the International Black Summit, and then we also have some other listeners that each of the hosts have invited.
Okay, great.
From their
great.
Personal listing,
great.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I'm going to take a quick minute to introduce myself. So I know Glenn from my 3 years of participation with the summit. I was a facilitator and an enfoldment manager in Tulsa and in Chicago. So that's where we met. We both were meeting every 3 months with the summit. What happened, Glenn, I don't know if you know this, before I moved from Chicago about 10 years ago, a young lady with the Youth at Risk there in New York, she challenged me to start getting involved in the financial arena so I can be a, provide jobs and funding in the black community. And so I don't think I've even talked to her since that, but I really took that as a mandate to create a shift for myself. So what I'm doing right now is I'm working full-time in the international banking arena, and for the purpose of creating funds to fund humanitarian projects, not only in our communities here in the United States, but in other countries as well. So I was very fortunate to have met in the course of my interaction with people in this arena Mr. Marvin Thomas, who will be on in a minute to introduce our special guest. So that's what brought me to where I am right now, Glenn, and that's going to be, you know, the motivation for what we're sharing is to create funds so people who have a interest in making a difference in the community, creating jobs, funding projects, can create the funds to do that. What I would like to ask, Glenn, is that anyone who have any questions after the call is over, they can contact me at my personal number, my business number, 773-716-5509, 773-716-5509, or they can email me at my business email, gilmore360@yahoo.com, G-I-L-M-O-R-E, 360@yahoo.com. So what I'm going to do right now, I'm going to introduce an associate of mine, Marvin Thomas, who's a long-term associate of the attorney that's going to be speaking with us briefly. And okay. Marvin will introduce himself, and then he'll introduce Attorney Marino.
Yes, Glenn. This is Marvin Thomas. I reside in Cincinnati, Ohio. I am a collaborator along with James Gilmore, and what I'd like to do is introduce the infamous John Marino Esquire from a very large international law firm that has an exceptional program that we should feel honored that he's here to explain it to us. John?
Great.
Yes. How are you, sir? It's a pleasure to meet you. At one time, we served as CAP counsel in various black neighborhoods. In fact, was a guest at the Black Caucus in the 70s, and that was a thrill to do that. It gave us some real insight into how it felt to be in an arena with 16,000 black people and about 4 white people. And it was quite an education. So we admire a lot of the work that you did. Back then, the government had some programs that minority business programs, which were exceptional because 95% of them continued, beauty shops, you know, auto shops, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a great program. I wish they'd bring it back. At any rate, we're about 800 lawyers in 9 countries. And so right now I'm in this lovely home in Boca Raton, Florida, in the Polo Club. I like to spend my winters here as much as possible. It's not always possible because we have offices in Rome and in Frankfurt and in Vienna and in Monaco and in Madrid and in Cyprus in particular, which is my favorite country because it's got a 2-term president in the parliament and virtually no crime, 0 unemployment. Its banks didn't buy $1 worth of the toxic assets. So it's, for all of those reasons, it's a wonderful, wonderful place. And you should go on a vacation. The people are friendly beyond belief. Everybody in the major cities on the Greek side, it's an EU member country, and everyone speaks English. So you feel very comfortable and very, very at home, and take your wife and your children, and you'll have the best vacation in your life. We heartily recommend it. We have wonderful government contacts there. Last I was there for months, and I had dinner with the president and the finance minister, the head of the central bank, and stayed in the apartment of the head of Cyprus Interpol as his guest, and that was lovely, and I'm buying a home there, and I do have another home in Italy, and attended law school in Germany and America, so speak 4 languages, and we worked 2 years. Now I'll get to the crux of this matter. Okay. We worked 2 years to develop a situation where individuals or entities or corporations with a limited amount of money could end up earning millions of dollars, and unlike a Madoff-type scheme, we would everyone at every step of the proceeding would get copies of all of the documents and further copies of all the wire transfers into our accounts in Cyprus and out so that everyone knew exactly how much money was coming in and how much money was going out and what their participatory interests were. So you'd have to understand a little bit about international law in order to put the parties together. You have to understand that in the United States, our government issues these T-bills and treasury notes, 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, 20, 30 year instruments. And they auction them $20 billion at a time, $40 billion at a time, and so many 5 years, so many 1 year, And there was just in the Wall Street Journal last week, I saw they issued, I think it was $24 billion of one-year paper at 0.78% interest. So that meant you had to pay $99,280,000 to buy a $100 million instrument. And there are two enormous sources of money in the world today, even in this trying times. One is in, of course, the Middle East, where they pump oil, and another is in the Far East, where they sell everything to the United States, particularly China, which pumped along at 12 to 20% a year for the last 15 years, and even they're in somewhat of a decline now. But
right.
China has, trust me, enormous amounts of cash. And there are Chinese corporations that we have represented in the past, major, major multi-billion dollar entities whose conglomerate consists of shipping divisions, manufacturing divisions, owners of office buildings and managers of real estate projects, construction projects. One of these companies has a road project to build a road from Shanghai to Beijing. And whether you build the road in China or you build it in the United States, it's so many millions of dollars per every 100 feet. And it's a multi-billion. So these are companies that have been in business for more than 40 years and have banked in the banks. And if you have any understanding of business in the Far East, particularly in China, you know that Singapore and Hong Kong are free zones, unlike mainland China or Japan or Taiwan, which have very strict currency controls. Those currency controls do not exist in either Singapore or Hong Kong. So these corporations have been customers of Standard Chartered Bank, Hong Kong and Singapore, HSBC Hong Kong and Singapore, Industrial Bank of China Hong Kong and Singapore, Bank of China Hong Kong and Singapore, and these banks are all in the top 40 banks world rankings. In the Bank of China is 28th, HSBC is about 11th, and they in part, the banks themselves, are in part owned by the Chinese government. And these corporations are in part owned by the Chinese government. So we went over in the last few years and spent literally hundreds of thousands of dollars meeting with government officials, bank officials, in order to accomplish these goals, which we have now completed. We did this with the Cyprus government, and I'll tell you in a moment why. We did it with the Swiss and the Swiss banking authorities, because in the European Union, and I'm an EU licensed EU lawyer, in the European Union, they also issue debt instruments. They have no choice but to issue debt instruments similar to American debt instruments. There are 470 million legal residents in the European Union today. So, and there's probably 30 million illegals, similar to what we have in the United States of America. But you can see they're 1.5 times our size in the entire economic bloc. And so ever since 1951, at the Bretton Woods Accords, the banks have been mandated to issue bank instruments, which the interest of which is guaranteed by the European Monetary Authority, European Banking Commission. Like the World Bank and IMF, they'll stand behind these instruments, and the European Union will. And so that typically, for example, you can buy a 10-year instrument for about 85% of face, and it will have a 4% coupon, so that paper is now, if you take a 1.5 and add it to the 4, you've got 5.5%, and CD rates in the United States at Bank of America and Citibank and J.P. Morgan are about 2.9. So that paper becomes very sellable. In fact, you can sell it, the paper that you bought at 90 for at 85 for 90 now that it's issued, and it has an ISIN number, which stands for International Security Identification Number. So there are other lawyers. There is an attorney known to us for more than 18 years. She is 48 years old, born in America, incidentally, and at the age of 8 months, in a suburb of Chicago, the family moved back to Europe. She was educated at the Sorbonne, and she worked at Zurich International Commercial Bank for more than 10 years, and for Credit Suisse for more than 10 years at a very high-level position. Today, she is a designated program manager for the banks so that she can take a client with funds, take them into the bank so there's no transparency, and get a bank contract to buy and sell these instruments, and the bankers and the traders take a portion of the profits, and the investors take a portion of the profits. what we were able to accomplish was a joint venture agreement between major multi-billion-dollar Chinese companies so that our law firm could put up there are banking fees and attorney fees payable in Zurich, payable in London. There is a company that will actually deliver for a set amount of money, a United States Treasury bill, which is a bearer instrument, in the amount of $100 million, and further send a sum of money now. They just this week changed the new guidelines. They used to send $80 million in cash. Now they will send $78 million in cash. And they will send it to a joint venture between an American investor and the Chinese company. And the only out-of-pocket expense to the investor in the United States is $300,000. Our law firm almost matches that. We put in $250,000 to cover the banking fees in the Far East and in Zurich. These SWIFT messages cost a lot of money. They actually cost $100,000 to send a SWIFT message in the amount of $100 million. So that it's not like sending a wire from Florida, where I am, to where you are, and the bank charges me $25 or $50. The banks charge a lot of money. So these fees have to be paid. However, we have structured escrow agreements that make it crystal clear that in the event the cash and the T-bill are not transposed and sent to the Chinese company in 21 days, every dollar is returned. We are not interested in, and I can tell you why, because our law firm, after the money is there, the Chinese and their banks have agreed to take $4 million from the $78 million cash and send it to me. Well, that is a very, very healthy fee. Which we share with one other law firm. So, but half of that is a very healthy fee, and every time we do one of these, we earn a few million dollars. So that's important to us. The second thing that's important to us is that in the client information sheet and in the joint venture agreement, we said to the Chinese government, we said that down and said, look, we're not going to chase you for the client's money or our money or the intermediary's money. We insist that if this earns, for example, we expect the $174 million to produce income of $174 million monthly, and that is a lot of money. And the joint venture agreement is very clear that the Chinese company receives 35% of that. The investor who put up the $300,000 receives 35%. The intermediaries who introduced the investor receive 10%. The program manager receives 10%, and she's a licensed EU lawyer, and we're licensed. We're about 800 lawyers in 9 countries, and we receive 10%. And all of those profits, and that's why I needed the cooperation of the head of the central bank and the head of the government in Cyprus, because if I'm going to bring in $174 million per transaction, and we're going to do this over and over and over again, then you know, that's a lot of money, and the EU auditors, just like American auditors from the Office of the Comptroller of Currency, they want to know, where's the money coming from? Why is all this money coming in? Why is it all going out? So we made it so that our law firm receives the funds in Cyprus, and then we pay the program manager, the intermediaries, the investor, and the investor can end up with something like $17 million a month for 10 months for $300,000. That sounds unbelievable, but trust me, when you cut this paper at 80% and sell it at 90%, because traders are doing this in $50 billion contracts, so that they get a little better rate than a guy that just buys a $10 million instrument.
Sure.
So they do it every day, so that the profits should equal that. With no difficulty. But even if it only made 600% a year, it's a humongous amount of money. It is an enormous amount of money, and it's an opportunity to take that money, to take $17 million a month and more, almost three times that for the investor, and fund humanitarian projects, do self-fund minority business opportunities, which is desperately needed, because I'm a lawyer and I represented community action programs, and I know that while the unemployment rate in California today may be 10.1%, I know in the black community it's closer to 28%.
Absolutely.
So we're very cognizant of that, and we have a lot of black attorneys and Chinese attorneys and every kind of attorney. My grandfather gave me a valuable lesson when I was very young. He took a $100 bill out. It was about 14 or 15. He said, "What is this?" And I said, "It's a greenback or a C note or a $100 bill or whatever you want to call it." He said, "What color is it?" I said, "I don't know, greenish, grayish." That's why they're called greenbacks, right, around the world? He said, "See this? This is the only color that matters." That's the only color that matters in this world. Because if you have enough of them, and I'm living in a $4 million home here in the Polo Club that's paid for. And I don't need to, and I drive a $100,000 sports car, and I have a similar home in Castel Marese del Golfo in Sicily. So I do very, very well, and we are very cognizant. We're not looking to one of my law partners is a licensed member of the New York bar, in very good standing at the bar, but he has never practiced law yet. I just said he is my partner. He holds every SEC license that they give in every commodities license. He is a partner in a licensed NSAD member broker-dealer and a FINRA member. And we cannot understand a scumbucket like Bernie Madoff or the Stanford or anybody. Last year, Frank graduated law school, passed the bar, went to work for Wachovia, then went to work for Merrill Lynch, and then ran Credit Suisse's investment bank in Miami, Florida, on Brickell Avenue for 4 years, and now is a partner in his own firm. And he will open up an account, and for this you need a minimum of $1 million. But you don't give the money to him as you did to Madoff. It's your account at Schwab or J.P. Morgan Chase Bank. And you go into the account every day and see this is what was bought, this is what was sold, this is what went long, this is what went short, this was the put, this was the – whatever it was, this is the currency they bought, this is the currency – whatever they did, it's your account and you can liquidate it at any time, write a check and close it. And last year, Frankie made 37% for every investor. Now, he doesn't do that every year, but I've known him 18 years, and I've never seen him make less than 12%. So I don't understand why a guy like Madoff, who was head of NASDAQ, couldn't find a way. If Frank could do it, why couldn't somebody else do it? Why did he have to be a crook?
True.
I mean, it aggravates us, because some of my law partners are Orthodox Jewish guys, and it gives them a bad reputation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they're very concerned about that.
Yeah, because they say, oh, look, it's another Jewish Wall Street banker who robbed the world.
Yeah, exactly.
And, they are concerned about it. It's come up quite a bit.
Now, we've got about 7 minutes left, John. So I wanted to get a couple of key points in terms of now, do you guys have a website?
We have a whole series of documents. If you'll provide your email to our law firm, deliberately never created a website, and I can tell you why. We represent gold refineries and gold buyers that are very substantial. We represent Chillington Oil, Valley Fuels. Chillington Oil last year did $53 billion. We represent CMAX. We represent GC Gulf, a group of companies, multi-billion dollar. If I were to put a website, I would get emails from every nitwit broker in the world offering me oil that didn't exist and gold that didn't exist. And we do extremely well, my partners and I. We make a lot of money practicing law because we have some high priority clients and very, very high net wealth corporations that we represent and have done legal work for many of the major banks in Europe. And we deliberately will not create a web, but there is a whole set of documents that we can send you if you just give me your email, and you can review them.
Gotcha.
At your leisure.
Okay.
All I can tell you is it is very safe and very secure.
And James has got access to all of this information, so we can contact James' email and get the information as well.
Absolutely.
Now, let me ask you this. Is there, because we've got about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
Is there any minimum requirements for this investment and any, sound?
No. Well, if an individual, I had a conference call today. You can obviously bypass the minimum And my co-counsel, who is a licensed DU lawyer, the program manager, she can place real estate, she can place artwork, she can place assets. The minimum, if you go direct and don't have the JV partner, we spoke to a gentleman's associate today who claimed that they have 98 million euros in an old state bank in Austria, and meine Deutsche sehr perfekt, ich war in der Schule für 4 Jahre in Deutschland. So, and I also speak Italian and Spanish. So, in that case, he doesn't need a JV partner. He will. The interesting thing about a buy-sell contract with my co-counsel is that, let's say you had the minimum for cash would be 10 million euros, and the floats today it's 126, so you need $12.6 million. Interestingly enough, if that existed, the money would, no signatory would be added to that account, no MT-760 would be blocked, you would fly to Zurich with me, you would go inside the bank, you would meet the bank officer and receive a bank contract inside the bank. So you would meet the program manager, the trader, and the bank officer and sign your bank contract in the bank. And one of the provisions would say that they would interbank screen. What does that mean? That means that every major bank in the world has a screen, and bankers can communicate with other bankers because they have magic little codes so that they know that they're not talking to Joe in some garage in the Philippines, that it's there are codes and numbers that the banks communicate, so that they block a credit line in Zurich, but your money is in J.P. Morgan Chase Bank in New York under your signatory control. Nobody can take it. Nobody can remove it. You give the bank the right, the authority to raise a separate credit line against your money. It is the credit line in Zurich that is responsible and has the liability to pay for the bank instruments. Your money is safe and secure over here in New York City or any other city in the United States. But it cannot be in the National Bank of Sioux City, Iowa. Why? Because they don't have an interbank screen. It would have to be in Wachovia or Bank of New York or J.P. Morgan Chase or Bank America or Wells Fargo or First Interstate. Has to be a major, major American bank that has an interbank screen. And that credit line is used to buy, in that case of this individual, should he elect to do this, will buy and sell 98 million euros, which is about $130 million of bank paper every day. And will buy it at X and sell for X plus Y, and he will get his portion. But in the case of a person or a corporation that only wants to has $300,000, and there is no bank program that he can do for $300,000, he can get into this JV with his multi-billion-dollar Chinese company and proceed and earn millions of dollars monthly from a $300,000 investment.
Excellent.
With no risk, because we will if that cash, if that $78 million and that Treasury bill is not delivered to HSBC or and we have proof of that delivery, within 21 days, his $300,000 is returned. We're not losing our law licenses for $300,000. It doesn't mean enough to us.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, this sounds pretty exciting. We've got 1 minute left. James, would you give your contact information before we go off the air? James?
I don't know. Is James still there?
He should be. Oh. Okay. Well, I just...
can you hear me, Glenn?
Now
there's James. James, are you on?
Okay, there he is. My contact information... the easiest email in the world to remember, Gilmore360@yahoo.com. That's Gilmore, one L, G-I-L-M-O-R-E, 360@yahoo.com. My business number is 773-716-5509 here in Chicago, Illinois.
Great city. Great restaurants. Good steakhouses.
Yes, great. Well, you're a very traveled man, so
I travel a lot. I just came back from Cyprus. I'm going to Dubai. Our law firm represents a major Brazilian client that is the owner of $6 billion worth of bearer Brazilian treasury bonds, and we've arranged a loan for her with Sheikh Mohammed Maktoum, who's one of the rulers of Dubai and also a director of HSBC Dubai. And so we'll be going over there to close that loan, and we'll take that $2.4 billion and put it into one of these buy-sell contracts in Switzerland.
Sounds excellent. Listen, this is the International Black Summit Wealth Club talk show. This is Glenn Greenidge, your host. We've got about 15 seconds left. I wanted to thank the three gentlemen for coming on and delivering to us a very exciting and interesting proposition. And we certainly will contact Mr. Gilmore to find out a little bit more about that. And with that, I thank you for being part of our show tonight. Appreciate all the insights
okay.
that you've made available to
all
us.
Right. Now I'm going to go eat my dinner. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. It's a well, pleasure to meet you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, John. Thanks a lot, Marvin.
Thank you, John.
Bye, Glenn.
Okay. Good
thank
night.
You, Glenn.
Thanks again. Okay. You're welcome.
Good night.